love.
You're listening to episode 5 of When Someone Great Is Gone. Today's episode contains themes of grief, death, and suicide, so it may not be suitable for all listeners. When I think of the word community, I think of the word love. I think of friends, I think of family, I think of extended family. And the love and wisdom and compassion that surrounds me in my everyday existence. But when I Google community, it comes up with a slightly different definition. The first definition is that it's a group of people living in the same place or having a particular characteristic in common. The second says that it's the condition of sharing or having certain attitudes and interests. But what does Google know anyways? I'd like to think that my definition is a slight hybrid of that. I was born into this amazing extended family. I have my amazing auntie, who's my mum's sister, and my cousin as well. But beyond that, I have a group and a network of fantastic, supportive, and wonderful women. I like to think that I didn't just have two mums, but many different mums, who I now refer to as the aunties, or sometimes the North London lesbians. When Kate died, I think my family depended on this network of women more than we'd ever anticipated. The whole community kind of raised us. Obviously, my mum Sue was the predominant caregiver, but this extended family has given me such an insight into different types of love and different conversations, and I still depend on these same women today, just to ring up if I'm sad, or have a great discussion with, or open a bottle of wine over dinner with. And what's been so amazing about knowing this extended family is that their love has been able to fill in the gaps of Kate's lack of existence. And I've learnt the wider story around my existence too, the difficulties with having same-sex parents in society at that time, how much love Kate had for me, and even some of her flaws. They loved Kate in a way that was spectacular. They grew up with her as adults. They fought for human rights and for a better, more equal and loving world with her. So I wasn't the only person that lost someone, and my family, my brother, my mum and I, weren't the only people that lost Kate. This is one of my aunties, Alice.
Kate's funeral was the most extraordinary experience. At the time I was working for Terence Higgins Trust, I was used to people dying all the time, and had been to lots of funerals. But Kate's was a sort of real affirmation of the North London, mostly lesbian gang, and its absolute strength and ability to create a ritual and a celebration all of its own. That although it was an incredibly sad time, and I really missed Katie, and listening to it all again reminds me of, living next door to Katie.
This is another of my aunties, Ria.
24th of May 1996, when we got the news from Katie that she'd got cancer, I was able to be of strength in that situation, just as a very sort of like straightforward sort of like person. You know, I just go into a mode, do you know what I mean? There were times when, you know, I used to come around and Sue would be at work and I would be taking Kate to her radiation or chemo, et cetera, do you know what I mean? And, you know, one time I remember arriving sort of thing, you know, and she wasn't dressed. She was very, very poorly. And it's like, you know, and picking her body up, you know. Now, for me, I'm not being morbid. I'm just saying that sort of like, you know, 2 years later, it's very, you know, I can't forget those little times, you know, but also they're very precious. Very precious. And the dignity that I think Kate gave me and for me to be sort of like dignified around her needs, do you know what I mean, was like, you know, very, very special. Very, very special, yeah. And then comes the sort of like, you know, the day of reckoning, and she sort of like dies. And it's like, oh, that's not fair, you know what I mean? Because you're now used to, you know, washing, bathing, sort of like appointments, sort of like, you know, cooking food, oh, talking to it. You know, you're doing all those things during that time, and then suddenly it stops. But then the next thing that happens is that sort of like, you know, the inner gang sort of like got together at the house, you know what I mean? And it was amazing to sort of like to see, you know, the women sort of like, you know, tuned in. There was dignity, do you know what I mean? And I'd never sort of like had a funeral around the actual grave, you know what I mean? And then sort of like six women, we lowered her into the ground. It was beautiful.
There was that hysterical point where we were carrying the coffin to put it in the grave.
Yeah.
And the bloody thing nearly opened and fell. It was ridiculous, if you remember. Yeah. Victor had to come and hold it and put it down.
Yeah. It was also, like, oh!
And I think that was also something that was truly wonderful about that funeral. It was incredibly sad, but we were also all people who could laugh at the funny bits. It wasn't terrible. And the whole thing was very real and immediate.
But Katie was, I think, the whole thing, because it was evolved round, you know, two children as well, yeah? And it was completely new to the whole world, you to me. And I think that's what's very special. And that's what Izzy and Danny is very special to me, anyway.
This is one of my aunties, Etty.
We were all part of political groupings, feminist, socialist. We went on demos, we went on all sorts of protests, we socialised, and there was just a big group of us. So that was what was crucial. I mean, I'd had other deaths, my parents had died, but was the first person in that community that I knew well who died. And that was very, very shocking. Very shocking. And it was very hard to kind of take in and believe it was happening. But then the practicalities took over, which was to try to support her in any way that we could. And obviously to support Sue and you and Dan. Sometimes at night I would think, I can't imagine what it's like to be Kate, knowing that you're going to die. I just couldn't imagine what that would be like. And I would go and see her and sometimes think, what on earth will I talk to her about? Because you, when somebody's in that situation, you want to comfort them. And often I would just say, Katie, I don't know what to say to you. And she'd say, Etty, just tell me what you're doing. It's lovely to hear about your life. Tell me about work. But I think there were an awful lot of people who were very helpful. And people did different things. I have a memory, I don't know what stage it was. I have a memory, if you can imagine this too, of Andra coming over one day and just taking over and saying, I'm cooking, and just cooking a meal. Now, that's not my style. I mean, it's not that I can't cook, but Andra just said, right, okay, out of the kitchen, Susie, I'm doing this, you know. And other people did different things. Alice and I thought we could spare Sue having to go to the undertaker, who I remember was opposite the Royal Free Hospital. And we went there, and what I was saying was that he was very funny about getting hold of a cardboard coffin, and Alice just said to him, well, we know how to get one, shall we get it? And then he obviously knew how to get it. And I used the fact that I was, because I couldn't say like I'm a sister or sister-in-law or anything like that, I said I'm one of the executors, so that gave me the status. And what I remember Alice saying, it was just complete chance that somebody who had been a student of mine at North London Poly had come in as the manager of all places at someone like Terence Higgins, where you'd think that people would understand the idea of community and other, you know, a different kind of idea of family. And that this woman had said to her, why are you having to spend so much time doing this? Hasn't she got a family? And Alice said, yes, and I'm part of it. And it's often stayed with me, that, because I thought it was such an important idea. And I suppose the thing with me is that I've never had much blood family because of my parents' history. I only had my parents and my brother. I didn't have anybody else in this country. So for me, the idea that family was the people you loved who were around you was something very positive for me anyway, not just in the context of this awful thing that was happening.
It's evident from listening to my auntie's experience of their own loss and the loss of Kate, that community is very much a choice, not just something you're born into. I think for people who navigate difficult family situations or have broken bonds with their parents or brothers or sisters, it's hard to feel a sense of community within a family unit. But my auntie's existence is living proof that you can create your own community, and that your family doesn't necessarily have to be blood family, but a chosen network and community of people that you trust and love and who understand you outside of a traditional family unit. Within my smaller family, it being my mum, my brother, my auntie and my cousin at the core of it, my cousin also lost her dad, Jack. And about a month ago, towards the start of this project, Jess and I had a really deep and meaningful conversation about what that felt like for her to lose her dad at that point in her life. We hadn't had such a frank conversation before, but in a sense, what she said really resonated with me. And opening up that dialogue between us as cousins made me also feel part of this grief club that she talks about.
So when Jack passed away, I felt in the few months after he passed away, maybe like 6 months after he passed away, I felt like I'd been let into a club that I didn't know existed before. And I just, for those 6 months, I kept meeting people who were at a similar stage of bereavement that I was. And it was almost like we could see it in each other, and we gravitated towards one another. And I've made some really great friends during that time because we were able to talk in really frank ways about grief and about losing somebody in a way that I didn't really feel like I could do with friends that hadn't lost someone close to them yet, or older people who had a lot of experience of loss. And it was just like this sort of strange club that I didn't know existed. And I do think that there is something in that. Like, I really do think that in terms of looking at my life so far, the thing that has changed me as a person the most in a short space of time has been that grieving process. I think when you lose someone or lose a parent, I don't know, because I don't have a huge amount of comparison on it. A small piece of you goes that you can't get back. And I wonder if that's like an innocence or a naivety about the world that you just then can't bring back. And I definitely feel like I have become an adult because of that process of grieving. There's a sort of gap or a disconnect, I think, between people who have experienced it and people who haven't. And that's not to say that one experience is, you know, better than the other or whatever. But it just makes you different, I think. And that's why I gravitated towards those people that were also experiencing grief. It's because there was some sort of connection there of like, oh, you know what I'm going through. And even if we didn't speak about it a lot, there was a comfort in knowing that somebody else sort of was on the same page as you emotionally, even if you were talking about something completely different. It's weird. It's really weird. It doesn't matter what age you are, you can belong to that club, actually. Like, I think whenever you have experienced that grief, whether it's as a child, as a young adult, as somebody in the sort of middle of their life, or I've got friends who are older than me who are experiencing that at the moment, and it is a bit of a club. You think about your life and you think about, you know, lots of different things as a result of that you didn't think of before.
Some of my friends are also members of this grief club, much like myself, Jess, and maybe you are too. By reaching out, I felt like I was speaking to my own community, my own extended family who understand and empathise what we've gone through. This is one of my best friends, Harriet, who lost her mum last year.
Hi, I'm Harriet, and I lost my mum to an aggressive form of bladder cancer in September last year. It had been a really long process, and she spent the last 3 months in a palliative care hospice with the most amazing nurses and carers around her. Quite a lot of my grieving process, I use music to get through it. I think my number one thing is a playlist of all of my mum's favourite pieces of music. And if I'm feeling rubbish or I need to feel close to her or I just want to sit and think, then I will put this playlist on and have a cry or blast them through the speakers and revel in all the moments that we spent together. And she loves singing and I sing as well, and so that makes me feel extremely close to her. Singing definitely has helped me and helps me get through it, and all my family do quite a lot of music, so we can all come together to celebrate her and grieve in that way. I think it's super important that you have a community or people around you to talk through grief. One of the things I hate the most about our society is the fact that hardly anyone talks about grief or knows how to deal with grief, and you have to hold on to the few friends who pull you through and know and just listen and know when you need a little pick-me-up or just want to talk it out or talk about the person that you've lost and the person that you love.
It seems that creativity can also form a community around grief, as well as your extended network of friends and family. Ellie Chapman is a dancer, choreographer, and creative director.
The person that passed away was my dad. My dad was the type of man who literally, well, like, family was everything, and just like made sure that I was always put first. In a sense, I was kind of like spoiled, if that makes sense, but it was because I was his only child. He was always told as well he couldn't have children, so I was always like his miracle child. But he was also like incredibly strict. I wasn't really allowed to go to parties or anything that I think put me at threat, just because he was so scared at any risk of me, if that makes sense. Dad was like a social worker, mental health. I think maybe where he was a social worker as well, because he heard so many bad things happening in the world, that made him even more protective. I think he was a very loving person, which I think is still where I get like a lot of my love from. He passed away when I was 16, and he had pancreatic cancer. So that's probably like one of like the hardest cancers to find. And he passed away within like 3 weeks of knowing that he had it, like diagnosed of it. So because he had diabetes, and like that's the same organ as like pancreatic cancer, it was very hard to like be detected. So then as it finally got detected, not that I kind of prepared myself for the worst, but I was very naive. And that's the thing that I think I found hardest within this whole process. Bearing in mind, in this summer, I was also moving back to London to go and attend the Brit School. So like little 16-year-old Ellie was so like, oh my God, I finally got into Brit School. I'm going to move back to London. Like my life's just like starting to like kick off. I think I only really cried because my dad cried, like, because in my head I literally had thought, oh, he's going to get better, like, it's fine, it's treatable, or, like, I had much longer than 3 weeks. I don't think he realised it was actually worse, him not telling me how high the stakes were. But you do that as a parent, don't you? Like, you're protective rather than telling someone how it actually is. So that's probably, like, the hardest thing that I've had to struggle with, is, like, the anger that I've dealt within myself from my dad's death. I hadn't seen him, I think, for like 2 weeks out of those 3 weeks that he'd been diagnosed, because I just moved to London. And in these 3 weeks, he was engaged to my stepmom. So they got married 9 days before he passed away. The last day that I fully saw my dad and had a conversation with my dad was on his wedding day. His wedding was probably like the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen, because it just meant so much to everyone in the room. even the register like started crying her eyes out because she knew how much the stakes were high. And I think that's kind of when I realised how high the stakes probably were, but still didn't realise I had just over a week left with my dad. We went for a meal afterwards, but even at the meal, like, my dad didn't really eat, and like, he loved to eat, like, he loved food. And then we had to just go home afterwards, and he had to just go lie down. And on his bed was like the last time I ever had a conversation with him. That's probably like one of the most memorable and meaningful conversations in my life. Because with everything going on in his life, all he wanted to know was what was going on in mine. At 16 years old, I was just too pure and just didn't realise, like, life, if that makes sense. Like, before my dad passed away, I'd never had anyone in my life pass away. Even, like, the dog that I grew up with passed away after my dad. So it was just, like, I hadn't experienced loss. So I studied dance, and I went to the Brit School when my dad passed away. So because that was such like a monumental like achievement for me, like I don't know, I just kind of prioritized that anyway. So like literally like I wanted to go into like college the day after he passed away, and my mum was like, "Are you like literally like crazy?" And I was like, "No, like I just want to go." So then my mum wouldn't let me go on the first day, but like literally I was just like, "No, I have to go in." Like, otherwise I'm just like crying at home kind of thing. So I remember like going in, but obviously starting at a new school, like I didn't really have any best friends at this point, or like, I mean, it's quite an intense way to start like a friendship group. For that first whole year at Brit, I was quite like resentful. I was like, I want to drop out. I don't think dance is for me. Like, because I just wasn't enjoying life, the one thing that normally did bring me love also wasn't doing that, because I just wasn't in that good headspace. I'd say like from a really young age, I had quite intense like mental health problems. For literally like 3 years of my dad passing, I like was in like quite a depressing, suicidal, like, yeah, like I just hadn't grieved or like healed. I definitely wouldn't say I grieved until I'd done 16, which was the show that I did based on my mental health of the first year of my dad passing away. And when I first started the show, I like, so because it'd been like so-and-so 2 years, I was just like, oh yeah, like I've grieved now because like it's been 2 years, but I hadn't grieved at all because I hadn't been to any counselling because I was so in denial. I would still like cry at just the instance of like speaking about my dad. Whereas now, because I've been through such a therapeutic process of making a show about my mental health and around my dad, and but then also I had to be so, like, I had to go to counselling every week when I was doing the show, because it was just so intense. And I think if I wasn't going through counselling, I wouldn't have been able to have made a show as amazing as I did. And I was so in denial about having counselling, because both of my parents were in mental health, so I felt almost like ashamed that I had to then go see someone else about my mental health, if that makes sense. And like, obviously I was offered it at Brit, but at that moment in my life I was just like, I still wasn't ready to talk about it. The show was called 16, like 6 and a teen, you know, like edgy artsy wise. I basically did like a short piece at like a little choreography competition at my university, which was only like 3 minutes long, just about like me dealing with like these emotions of like depression. Like there was like 4 people representing like my mind, and then one girl who was to represent me, and just how the mind had so much control over myself. I basically like wrote my own kind of like story of how I wanted it to develop. So there was, I think, 6 scenes. So there was the opening, there was breathing, then that there was emerge, and then there was inspection, then there was insanity, and then there was choice. So there were 6 scenes that I like had made the story of how I wanted to follow through that first kind of year of how I was feeling. So for me, dance has always been a passion and a love, but at the same time, it's always been a voice of when I can't express something verbally, which I struggle with quite a lot. I can let it out physically. Just having dance as another way of like communicating things is so important. It's 100% a language, and like even if you look at like physical therapy, like dance therapy, it's used because sometimes it's so hard to actually hear things said out loud. It's easier to say it physically. I generally gave myself dance therapy, and I still do to this day. Like if I need to just let something out, I'll improvise, like, or if I'm happy, like all you want to do naturally as a person is dance. I don't think dance is celebrated enough at all as a way of therapy, because yeah, like what do you do on a night out when you're happy? You go dance. If you have a passion and a love in life, whether it be dance, whether it be music, whether it be whatever, like if you know that's more than just like a hobby, like chase it, because that's your passion and you won't be able to do anything in your life as good as what you could do with that one skill. So white feathers is like, it's meant to be a sign of when your guardian angel's here. So like I like believe that my dad is like my guardian angel, so like I just get white feathers like randomly, like say if I'm having like a really rubbish day, I somehow always get like a white feather or something like that, or like when I'm walking, like I'll just see like a white feather along the floor and I just like start smiling to myself like, oh, dad's here. Your time will come when you connect again to like that spirit again, and you'll always have a part of whoever you've lost within you. Time is a healer, but also when you know you're when you need to go and get help. For some reason, I had to go through all of that pain, and I had to actually risk taking my life to be the person that I am now, because now I literally love myself so, so much, and I know that brings my dad so much joy.
That was Ellie Chapman, dancer, choreographer, creative director and podcast host, remembering her dad and how she uses dance to creatively express her grief. That was episode 5 of When Someone Great Is Gone. When Someone Great Is Gone is a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse, presented and produced by Izzy Lee Poulton and co-produced by Bridie Addison Child. A special thanks to James Tyndale for additional editing on the podcast, and to Marie and Nikki from the Roundhouse for facilitating this project. I'd also like to give a special thanks to all of my loving friends and family for speaking on this podcast and all of the episodes before.